Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a new Obama military intelligence doctrine emerging that builds upon the Libyan example of intervention without boots on the ground. The founder and editor of SomaliaReport.com, Robert Young Pelton, joins us to discuss a new war going on in Somalia that employs U.S. naval and air assets, including drones, but uses Kenyan and Ugandan boots on the ground to fight the Islamist al-Shabaab militia. Then we'll talk about the national revival of Sinclair Lewis's novel and play It Can't Happen Here, a prophetic warning from the 1930s of how fascism could take over in the United States, opening now in performances and readings across the country. The organizer of this political and literary awakening, author, actor, and comedian Daryl Henriquez, joins us along with Professor Joel Schechter, who teaches dramatic literature criticism and theater history. We will discuss similarities between today's economic hard times and political extremism and the era in which It Can't Happen Here was written and performed by actors who actually worked for the United States government under the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. Then finally, we'll speak with British historian and author Robert Lacey, the author of Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. As the Cold War between Saudis and Iranians heats up, we will discuss the paradox that as rebellious Arab youth drive the region towards liberalism and reform, the ruling gerontocracy in Saudi Arabia appears to be heading in the opposite direction. Joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. Robert Young Pelton has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And it does seem that we have a new war front, if you will, in Somalia and Kenya. And we just apparently sent troops into Uganda. Many people think that was a payoff for the extent to which Ugandan troops have been dragooned into helping the U.S. out in Somalia. You published SomaliaReport.com, which is the most comprehensive and thorough analysis of what's going on in that beleaguered and war-torn country. Give us an update on what's happening there on the border with Kenya.
Yeah, well, what's happened is that the Kenyan military has gone into Somalia through its southern border, which neighbors with Kenya. And as you know, Kenya's had a number of problems, not just with the recent kidnapping, but with years of incursions by Somali. So they are, I think, well justified in going into that border after the kidnap of the two aid workers, two tourists, one of which died in captivity. The interesting thing, though, is that they're also coordinating this attack with some aviation and naval assets supplied by France and the U.S., and both these countries deny having any activity or participation in it. And the third, more complex thing is that the TFG, which is the temporary government or transitional government in Mogadishu, has now come out against the Kenyan incursion, even though they approved it and met with these people before it happened. So it's kind of like a three-ring circus.
But just a little bit of history, though. During the George W. Bush administration, the United States came up with this idea that the best way to break al-Shabaab and its alleged connection to al-Qaeda in Somalia was to use the Ethiopians and U.S. special forces, along with the Ethiopian army, invaded Somalia. And that turned out to be a total disaster, surely, because of the traditional enmity between Somalis and Ethiopians. So
that's correct. In 2006, the Ethiopians, using sort of Soviet-style artillery and tanks and U.S. air support, went in, pushed out the ICU, the Islamic fundamentalist units there, and then created al-Shabaab, which is sort of an al-Qaeda-sponsored kind of mutation of what we would call the Taliban in Afghanistan or the ICU in Somalia. But the interesting thing is that al-Shabaab is a very tiny, sort of unsynchronized group of fundamentalists. So they had a stranglehold in Mogadishu. They were kicked out of there. They basically fled from Mogadishu. They used Kismayo, which is a small port in the southern part of Somalia, to fund most of their activities. The Kenyans are going for Kismayo. They're going to cut Al-Shabaab off from their source of income, and hopefully they'll squeeze them between the Ugandan soldiers, which the U.S. pays via the U.N. to fight Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu, and the Kenyan army. What happens next, though, is the big question.
And what is the status, then, of some of these kidnappings? Because two Westerners were seized in northern Somalia, and they've been, of course, you mentioned earlier, the Kenyans responding to kidnapping. Two Spanish staff workers for Médecins Sans Frontières were grabbed in northern Kenya. So what's the latest in terms of the latest abduction? Because I think an American aid worker from a Christian aid group has been kidnapped, hasn't he?
The gal that was kidnapped is 32 years old. She used to be a fourth grade teacher in Rosslyn, Virginia. The other gentleman is a Danish manager of the Danish demining group that works out of, usually out of Hargeisa, but they've got an office in Nairobi. They had just finished giving a class and were on their way to the airport when their own security team kidnapped them. And we've been tracking them on Somali Report, and we've been talking to the people who are holding them and the people that kidnapped them. So it seems like this is not connected to the Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab kidnappings in the south. The three kidnappings in the south, we think, are part of a plan that was hatched by Al-Qaeda earlier on to disrupt the tourism industry and to essentially lure Western troops into Somalia.
So if that's their plan, are we falling for a sucker punch, or are they made a mistake?
Well, unfortunately, the Kenyans might have fallen for a sucker punch. There are no U.S. troops in Somalia. There are some CIA-paid Americans that are training, and of course there's French intelligence agents and other people. But we are, when I say we, the United States has learned quite a few lessons from Libya and other wars to keep out. I mean, to make this look like a local fight, even though we're paying for them and providing intelligence support and logistical support and financial support.
So what then are the possibilities? I've been seeing reports, Robert Young-Pilton, that this could be the death blow against Al-Shabaab. They're not that big and they're not that powerful, but they're fairly tenacious, aren't they?
Yeah, this would be the death blow against Al-Shabaab as a military organization. They are going to morph into a terrorist organization. And as you've seen from the two grenade attacks in Nairobi and the previous attacks in Uganda and some of the car bombs in Mogadishu, they're going to simply resort to Taliban-type tactics where they don't fight on a front, per se, but they will continue to do suicide attacks, bomb attacks, IED attacks against what they consider to be foreign occupiers.
And Robert Young-Pilton, again, founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. The American aid worker kidnapped along with the Danish demining specialist. She wasn't with the Danish demining group, but it does make you wonder what kind of country we're dealing with. Getting rid of mines, you think, would be in everybody's interests.
Well, and being kidnapped by confuse criminal and political acts. This is a criminal act.
I see. So the fact that their own bodyguards kidnapped them, that says it all, right?
Well, just a little background. The pirates are not doing very well. If you read Somali Report, some of the reports we've done show very clearly that their cash flow is down. They're getting desperate. They've essentially put out orders for anyone who can find a Westerner. They usually bring about $400,000 to $500,000 in ransom. So we think this is a pirate group we know very well that's based out of Habyo and Whistle. They're currently holding a crew of the MV Leopard, and they need more money. So they're willing to compensate people if they can deliver Westerners to them.
So the word is out then. Just you grab a Westerner and you got a customer.
Just like a menu, you're worth $400,000 because the ships bring in about $4.5 million, but they're getting harder and harder for them to grab. And as they hold them for longer and longer periods, it cuts into their cash flow. So they're trying to make a quick bump with these kidnappings. And like I said, the jury's still out on whether the southern kidnappings, which was the French lady who died, the English lady who died, and the two aid workers who are still alive, whether these were just criminal motivations, because we've tracked the Miss Tebbit to the same area in central Somalia. So we think it's a combination of both terrorist and also financial gain attacks.
And Robert Young-Pelton, again, founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. When you just mentioned that the pirates aren't doing as well as they have in the past in terms of kidnapping and ransoming, apparently that was a fairly sophisticated operation in the sense that transactions were done abroad and there are brokers abroad. And I've never understood why it is that, you know, we've captured a couple of pirates, killed a couple of pirates, and there's an awful lot of naval assets out there chasing pirates. But why not go after the middlemen and paymasters?
Well, because the insurance industry condones the payment of ransom. Their logic is that the pirates fully intend to give you back your personal property and people's lives, so payment of a ransom is just expediting that. They don't look at it as supporting this industry. But I have to say this, that the Navy only has about 25 ships in the region, but they've been very successful in both tracking the pirates before they head out on shore and keeping them away from ships. The shipping industry, I was just in Sweden talking at a convention of maritimers, have done a very good job of hardening their ships and being on the lookout for them. And the actual pirates themselves, there's over 1,000 pirates in jails around the world and 750 waiting for trial. And the locals have taken up arms and kicked the pirates out. So I honestly think that piracy is on the decline now, but it doesn't mean it's over.
And you were just there on, didn't you take a ship from Somalia to Aden in Yemen?
Other way around. I went from the UAE to Somalia on what they call the love boat. It was a ship that was going to be sent to be scrapped, but I wanted to experience firsthand what it's like to sail through the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. And there were a number of attacks while we were at sea, but nobody wanted to attack my ship. But once again, it's just important to see just how big the ocean is and how many pirates are out there.
And you could see that they were?
Well, yeah, they scout you out. There's a number of small fishing vessels many, many miles offshore. They scout you out. You can see them off in the distance, and they're looking for a certain kind of vessel, a certain what they call low and slow, something that travels under 15 or 12 knots and something that's got a low freeboard so they can get their ladders over the side. And they're finding less and less of those. And, of course, the prevalence of armed security on ships, which is essentially the rebirth of the security business we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, is also preventing a number of piracy attacks. Almost 90% of piracy attacks are prevented by armed guards.
So they didn't go after your ship because it was heading for the scrap heap? Is that...
We had a high freeboard. It's a 160-meter ship that would have taken about, I don't know, maybe 18, 20 feet to get over the side. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop them from checking us out, but, you know, at the end of the day, they'll go for easy pickings.
So tell me about the U.S.'s, you mentioned earlier that the U.S. is adopting a new strategic approach here to these small wars in the sense that maybe Libya has proven to be an example for, I take it, the National Security Council, the President, Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. New head of CIA, General Petraeus, are they figuring that the model worked in Libya and we can expand it elsewhere and keep our fingerprints off, keep the boots off the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, by the way, this is not new. This is actually very old. Using proxy forces was how the British expanded their empire and how we used to do business in many countries. You find local insurgents, you train them, you support them, you create a coalition, but you don't call it a coalition of the willing. You basically find enough people. In the case of France and Italy and all these people, they are the ones that were suffering the most from the potential cutoff of oil. So we essentially provided the support for the attacks in Libya. And if you look at the film footage out of Libya, one has to wonder where all those people got all those weapons very quickly and how all those airstrikes hit certain targets. It's because they had people on the ground doing that. In Somalia, we have even less interest in putting Americans on there because of Black Hawk Down. But it's a very geostrategic point, and it still is a safe haven for terrorism. So what you're seeing is working with France, working with local neighbors like Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya, we can build up their forces, train them, and then send them in, help them with the intel, help them with the coordination and deconfliction, and then let them take the credit for kicking al-Shabaab out.
And so what is the U.S.'s base in Djibouti all about? Because that's apparently a pretty substantial base with I don't know how many U.S. forces. I think they also share it with the French, and I take it that a lot of the drone activity in Yemen comes out of there, doesn't it?
Yeah, Camp Lemagne is originally a French Foreign Legion base with about 2,500 French people. We have about 1,500 Americans there. It was set up as part of what they call CJOTF HOA, you know, Horn of Africa. Special operation troops have been based out of there since 2002. The drone program just came up to speed in Somalia, but yes, it became a big spot for launching drone strikes in Yemen. The biggest problem was they couldn't get enough Reapers, which are the long-distance, heavy payload drones. There is an active drone program in southern Somalia against Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab. They fly some of those out of the Seychelles, but there's also a lot of Navy support. The USS Enterprise is offshore there. We have a number of destroyers and naval ships. We also have massive aviation capability through satellites and other high-tech things. So we're not invisible, but we're definitely not on the ground, but we're providing a very robust support for getting rid of terrorism in the region.
So you mentioned Robert Young-Pelton, again, publisher and founder of SomaliaReport.com. You mentioned that we're now operating drones out of the Seychelles. That's quite a distance, isn't it, to Somalia?
Yeah, but a drone, I don't have the facts in front of me, but if you go on Somalia Report, you can see my report called Enter the Drones, which gives you the specifics. You buy drones in a pack of four. They go out for almost 12 hours at a time. They can cover almost 1,000 miles, and you replace them as they come back for fuel. You send another one up. But then you can also coordinate with Navy ships. Don't forget, you can you can launch carriers off of the Enterprise and drop strikes that way. The Predators have to be armed with Mavericks. You can only get a couple of good hits in, so it's a little bit more complicated. But right now you're seeing a combination of both naval bombardment, which are just basically ships from France and the U.S. firing guns. You're seeing drone strikes, which you can't hear or see drones, but because of that, people assume they're drone strikes. And you see also aviation strikes from both Kenya, who has some MiGs, and other allied air forces.
But the Reaper that you mentioned, that's a bigger drone, right, that has more firepower and
longer range as well, yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of activity going on here, clearly.
And the reason why I got into Somalia, I've done similar news services in Iraq and Afghanistan. The reason I moved to Somalia is because that's where we're going to be. That is the most geostrategic point on the map. And we involved in Iran in much the same way, with naval support, air support, but no sort of troop support, which is also why I think Obama was pulling troops out of Iraq as fast as he can, because he doesn't want them close enough to Iran for retribution.
So we're pulling out of Iraq, but we're escalating activities against Iran?
So internally, we've been supporting insurgent groups and ethnic groups for a very long time, obviously since the 70s when they took over the embassy. But we've always been pushing, when I say we, the State Department, not me, has been pushing a lot of items into the news stream about how bad and evil Iran is, whether it's this assassination plot to kill a Saudi prince or providing EFPs against our troops in Iraq. They just keep the drum beat up. And the Navy and the Air Force hasn't had a good war, and they've got a lot of munitions, and it's very easy to access that country from either land bases or sea bases. So that's what I'm predicting.
So, in other words, Robert Young-Pelton, the Obama administration has a very, very robust and active national security menu out there. They're not just sitting down and reacting. They're being proactive. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do it the very easy way, take a map of the world, circle all the countries that are considered rogue regimes, and you would have seen that Iraq was one of them, Afghanistan under the Taliban was one of them, Libya was one of them, and there's only a couple left. You've got North Korea and you've got Iran, and that's pretty much it to clean up most of the politics in the Northern Hemisphere.
So how is the U.S. going to take on Iran without boots on the ground and fingerprints? Who's going to do the heavy lifting?
You've seen Libya, and you've seen that a combination of airstrikes, literally thousands of airstrikes, and a quickly assembled mob of people with anti-aircraft guns on the back of pickup trucks can do some serious damage. And Iran's military is very Soviet style. You know, it's very easy to pick them off using some of the smart weapons we have. So what you'd see is sort of a replay of what happened in Iraq, where almost most of Iran's Navy and military forces and Air Force would vanish. They'd be blown up, leaving it open to the ground troops to duke it out in a very messy sort of partisan-type war.
But who would be the U.S. surrogate in terms of the rebels in Iran?
You know, just you got to go to Washington cocktail parties and see who the flavor of the month is. They have been supporting diaspora and expat groups who are opposed to the Iranian mullahs for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. So that you think that this is all being ramped up now? I mean, in other words, as far as Petraeus now, the head of the CIA and Obama and company are concerned, Libya worked, and this is the model to build on, and then the next target is Iran.
Right, because Iran is the last domino, for lack of a better word, in the sort of chain of dictators in that region and rogue regimes. It's an oil-rich country. It borders a number of very strategic partners, whether it's Turkey or Afghanistan or Iraq. It is constantly known as a disturber, for trying to be polite, and it's very easy to topple. There are a number of very disaffected groups inside that country. We've been working with a number of these ethnic and also religious minorities to create a very messy democracy, just like Libya. Things are not pretty, and because we can blame it on them or give them the credit, we don't lose any political points because we've got dead soldiers, and nobody sees the secret budgets or the air flights, so the journalists don't cover the war. And I was surprised during the whole Libyan conflict how little the U.S. was dragged into it, because they were essentially invisible.
But you're one of the few people that actually have gone to Somalia. And talk about an invisible country. Nobody wants to go there, right? And yet we're ramping up a war there, too.
Well, the war is on. I mean, it's not ramping up. But what we've done is create enough proxy forces, either by hiring Ugandans at $1,200 a pop through the U.N., or supporting Kenyan troop training, or just supporting the sort of the political process. We're setting the stage. It's called putting the frog out of the pot. If you keep heating the water up slowly, nobody notices until it gets too hot, and then the frog hops out. And that's really the new political strategy.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Robert Young Pelton. Interesting conversation.
It is my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. Robert Young Pelton has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
It won't happen twice, my friend. And I know, because I know it, child. It cannot happen again.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joel Schechter and Daryl Henriquez. Professor Joel Schechter teaches dramatic literature, criticism, and theater history. He previously taught at the New School for Social Research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and at the Yale School of Drama. He now teaches at the San Francisco State University. And Daryl Henriquez is an author, actor, and comedian. He's well known throughout the Bay Area for having been a member of the San Francisco mime troupe. And the play of written in the 1930s by Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, is getting something of a revival around the country. Who, tell me, Daryl, who's responsible for organizing this? It seems to be tapping in to the zeitgeist.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to confess that it came to me as an idea after seeing the Tim Robbins movie, The Cradle Will Rock, and then learning for the first time in my life, even though I'd studied theater, that there was this thing called the Federal Theater Project. And I read about it, and a book came out recently called Furious Improvisation, which is a sensational history of the Federal Theater. So I was at the Actors Gang one night, and I spoke to the managing director, and I said, you know the story about It Can't Happen Here and how it was put on in several theaters on the same night to celebrate the first anniversary of the Federal Theater. And we should really do that. We should recognize that and maybe get a lot of theaters around the country to do a reading of the play. And they told me to email them, and emailed them, and they weren't able to do it. But I kept on talking to people, and one thing led to another, and we ended up with 22 readings in 17 different cities in 13 different states.
And I believe here in Los Angeles tonight, Wednesday night, at 8 o'clock, it's playing in North Hollywood at the, what is it called, Deathworth, the Antaeus Theater?
Yes, Antaeus is putting on a reading tonight at Deathworth.
So, Professor Joel Schechter, the play by Sinclair Lewis, the book, the novel, was published in 1935, It Can't Happen Here, and it features this folksy, self-conscious, plainspoken Southern politician, Buzz Windrip, appealing to America's the common man, but he's really a kind of a shill for the plutocrats, and it's a parable, if you will, about the possibility of American fascism, prophetic warning, if you will. I must say, without being too polemical here, it does. Buzz Windrip reminds me quite a bit of Governor Perry.
I think we've had a number of political figures who have some of his tendencies toward either fascism or support of plutocracy. And it's probably no accident that 75 years later, after this play first was opened across the United States in 21 theaters on the same night, that in another era of Great Recession or Depression, we face similar, though not quite the same, political turbulence, and it's time for the theater once again to remind people of the situation we're in. So this play seems to merit reconsideration, and for that matter, I think the whole Federal Theater Project, which was created 76 years ago, ought to be reconsidered. The WPA, which put millions and millions of Americans back to work, offered 10 to 12,000 actors and theater artists paying jobs at a time when so many were unemployed. And at this time when there is so great a need for more jobs, what the WPA was doing, not only for artists, for many working Americans, but also for the people who labored in theater, is a wonderful idea whose time ought to come again.
Well, but in terms of the work by Sinclair Lewis, this you know, political dystopian a parable, if you will, It Can't Happen Here. Perhaps we've had Buzz Windrips or bits and pieces of them in a lot of politicians. Arguably, George W. Bush, a Southern politician, tried to be folksy. Really, actually, came from the plutocratic class.
Yeah.
But Perry seems to be sort of echoing a lot of really kind of crass plutocratic policies. At the same time, wrapping them in religion and you know, a freedom, of course, being the new freedom that Windrip vaunted in the book. I mean, I'm not trying to as I say, I wasn't trying to be polemical, even though I probably am. But I just see a lot of echoes there, and particularly in Perry in the current race.
Yeah, I think you could see those, and also at the same time recognize the historical reference in the play to fascism rising in Europe. In a way, this play was a response to Hitler and Mussolini and to the Americans who wanted someone like Hitler or Mussolini to run the country in the 1930s. And So it may speak to the present in terms of some of our current presidential candidates, but I think it also spoke in the 1930s to the rise of fascism and fears by Lewis and others that it could happen here. And it's not just a matter of the political leaders, as the newspaper editor, Doremus Jessup, says in the middle of the play. You know, it's not just big business or the political leaders who let this happen. It's us, the ordinary people, who didn't protest enough when it was beginning to happen. So it's also a play about ordinary American citizens who don't anticipate the difficulties that these leaders, surprise policies from the leaders may bring. And I think that, too, is very important. Since there are so many protests going on now across the country, in a way, maybe we're in a different state where people have anticipated some of the problems that could lead to fascism, and they are stepping forward and speaking out. And the theater can do that as well.
And Darrell Henriquez, you're organizing these plays around the country, these performances of the Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, then adapted into a play, It Can't Happen Here. Joel was just saying that it was obviously a response to what was happening then, which was the rise of Nazism in 1935. I don't think there's much question in the historical record that America's elite, a lot of them, supported Hitler. So it could have happened here if the elite would have had its way. I'm talking about the DuPonts, the Henry Fords, George Bush's grandfather, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Ian, I wanted to tell you that one of the things that the Federal Theater is famous for is something called a living newspaper, in which they would take the actuality of what was happening. And they had journalists and theater people putting together these shows. And the first one they did was called Ethiopia, and it was about the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. And the State Department wouldn't let it be put on because they didn't want to insult any other world leaders. And so during the course of the Federal Theater, they were not allowed to talk about anything that was happening that involved world leaders around the world. And it's like, these people can be our friends one day, and they can be our enemies the next day, but be sure you don't insult them. And the other thing I wanted to tell you is that I went to one of the readings on Monday night, and during the intermission, I turned to someone, and I said, my God, who knew that Sinclair Lewis had written this play 10 minutes ago? And it was like everything that was being talked about in the play was happening in our society today. And the other thing I want to mention is the fact that when we have political leaders that without compunction break the law with impunity, we are going down a road that leads directly to the kind of situation that Sinclair Lewis warned us about.
And in terms of the component of a fascist takeover, if as in the 1930s, a big chunk of the American elite supported the Nazis, but we also had the countervailing power of unions and the Depression and all these people out of work, and FDR was actually the president, a huge kind of bulwark against it. Nevertheless, in the popular culture, there was Father Coughlin in the media. I mean, if he doesn't, if
He's
Glenn Beck and
if in the play, actually, there's a character like him in the play.
Right. Well, I'm saying, isn't that the contemporary versions of that? Aren't they Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity? I mean, these are the people that are railing against the 99% people that are now demonstrating.
You're right. I think one counterforce to that in the theater was the democratic potential of the Federal Theater Project. When this play opened in 21 theaters across the United States, it was a very democratic and decentralized kind of protest through the arts. And I think the Federal Theater Project was also very culturally diverse. There was a Yiddish production of this play. There was one done in Spanish in Tampa. It employed many people who needed work across the country. And in a sense, it represented an alternative to fascism in democratic government and funding for the arts from the government, which we haven't seen the like of since. So I think one reason to celebrate this play now on its 75th anniversary is the potential for democratic expression across the country and cultural diversity that it represented and that it kept alive through theater.
And Joel Schechter, do you think that obviously it's politically dead on arrival, the notion of a WPA being revived, although some serious people like Robert Reich and others have suggested that that's what we need. We, instead of the sort of shovel-ready stimulus package that clearly wasn't enough, that we could, with a little more imagination, we could employ a lot of people. We know that that the dysfunction in Washington is such that nothing is going to be done to improve the economy. But nevertheless, you know, we have this phenomenon of a spontaneous demonstration throughout the country and in parks all around the country. The Occupy Wall Street movement has spread across the country and around the world. What's your sense of new political possibilities?
Well, in a sense, we have new political theater in Occupy Wall Street. I mean, people have taken to the streets. It's a kind of street theater. But I would love to see a call for a new WPA, perhaps not exactly what existed 75 years ago. But I think if people begin to understand what was possible with government spending, instead of spending a lot of money on war and battleships, spending it on the arts and employment, there was a model there. One statement Hallie Flanagan, head of the Federal Theater, made was, the cost of 2 years of this program in the arts for employing over 10,000 people was $22 million. I think it was half the price, or the price of half a battleship. And I think if we can begin to use money from government budgets for arts and culture and education and healthcare rather than battleships, we're on the way toward a new kind of government spending and perhaps a new kind of WPA, but people have to be aware of the old one to know that it's possible.
And Darrell Henriquez, the idea that that there's a confluence going on here of reviving Sinclair Lewis's "It Can't Happen Here" from the 30s and spontaneous theater that's erupting in town squares all across the country and around the world. So it feels there's an interesting synergy going on here. Did the cart come before the horse or the horse before the cart in terms of your idea of putting this play on around the country and now having this political movement out there in the zeitgeist?
Well, I started asking people to get behind it before Occupy Wall Street started. So when that happened, it just was astounding to me, and then the other thing about it was, it turned out that the actual date of the original production was October 27th, and we chose October 24th because it was a Monday night, and most theaters are dark on Mondays. And then it turned out that October 24th is the 82nd anniversary of Black Thursday and the crash of Wall Street, which obviously is still reverberating around the world. And so it was like, I can't believe this. This is all happening. It's all coming together.
It's all coming back.
And the one thing that I wanted to say about the WPA is that we don't remember our history in this country. And so people around the country can go into buildings that were built by the WPA. They can cross bridges that were built by the WPA. It's like all of the fruits of the WPA are still around us, and a lot of us aren't even aware of it. And that was the thing that really astounded me, was that I had studied theater in the UC system, and then I see this movie, and I realize they didn't tell me about this. This was like a mystery. And so to learn about it finally was really a blessing to me, and to become aware of this project that lasted 4 years that did so many great things. And as Arthur Miller said, several of the people from the Federal Theater who went on to lucrative careers in Hollywood, he said that And the entire program could have been paid by them in income taxes over the next 15 years. He said, I'm not exaggerating. Their income tax probably paid for the whole damn thing.
Well, in terms of the work of Sinclair Lewis, of course, he got the Nobel Prize, there aren't too many, I think, American literary figures that were that political, and particularly on the left. You know, that the political left has been largely beaten down in this country, particularly starting during the Cold War. And I think it's very hard for people to recognize that it was how powerful it was in the 30s. But my understanding of Sinclair Lewis's work was that he was essentially a kind of chronicling the middle class's angst of facing the Depression. And Joel Schechter, isn't that what's happening now? Aren't the middle class wondering whether they're going to be downsized or become extinct? I mean, the GAO just issued this report that proves unequivocally that the top 1% are literally raking it in and have been raking it in at the expense of the middle class, not to mention, you know, the vast majority of working Americans.
Yeah, I think that's very likely that not only the middle class, but the forgotten unemployed, and you know, in the 30s, they had the phrase "the forgotten man." They referred to the League of the Forgotten Men in the play by Lewis, and I think there are many people who've been forgotten or left by the wayside in our economy. And I think the arts, particularly theater, can raise consciousness and make people more aware of this. When you mentioned Lewis as a novelist, one very interesting thing about the history of this play is that it began when MGM bought the film rights to the novel and then probably read the novel and realized they didn't want to make the film. Rumors have it they were afraid of offending Mussolini and Hitler by making this into a film. So Hallie Flanagan and the Federal Theater came along and said, well, we can do it as a play. We can do it all over the country. And Lewis was very attracted to this idea, the fact that this decentralized theater system would get his play out to Americans across the country. And by the end of its run, it had the equivalent of a 5-year run on Broadway, but it wasn't on Broadway or only in New York. It was all over the country. So it was a very effective means of reaching a large public with live theater performance about a very timely subject.
Well, that sounds like what Darryl's trying to do now, right?
Yes. I think it is time to think again of reaching the public with this kind of play and creating new plays that will continue this dialogue and discourse about what the country needs to do in crisis.
Well, just a last word from you, Darryl, since you've organized this.
I would like to just quote Hallie Flanagan. She said, "We want to do It Can't Happen Here, because like Dormus Jessup, the novel's newspaper man and hero, and his creator Sinclair Lewis, we, as American citizens and as workers in a theater sponsored by the government of the United States, should like to do what we can to keep alive the free, inquiring, critical spirit, which is the center and core of a democracy."
Well, I thank you both for joining us here today, Joel Schechter and Darryl Enriquez.
Thank you.
Again, Joel Schechter is a professor who teaches dramatic literature, criticism, and theater history. He previously taught at the New School for Social Research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and at the Yale School of Drama. He now teaches at San Francisco State University. And Darryl Enriquez is an author, actor, and comedian. He's well known throughout the Bay Area for having been a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. He has organized the productions around the country, or play readings, of Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, throughout all around the United States and here in Los Angeles. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Every day for the mask, hope my fist right. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. La 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 la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Robert Lacey, a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, a biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom, a study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machines, and Great Tales from English History. His other books include biographies of the gangster Meyer Lansky, Princess Grace of Monaco, and a study of Sotheby's Auction House. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia, a modern history of the Saudis, in their own words, revealing a people attempting to reconcile life under religious law with the demands of a rapidly changing world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lacey.
Thank you, Ian, very much.
And clearly, with the death of the Crown Prince and the likely secession of Prince Nayef, many commentators are looking at Saudi Arabia and seeing comparisons with the gerontocracy in the Kremlin towards the ends of the Soviet Empire.
Well, that's certainly true in terms of age. It's not perhaps taking full account of the culture of Saudi Arabia. I was just talking to somebody the other day and realizing that something that Saudi Arabia doesn't have, and with its economy it has just about everything it wants, is old people's homes, because all old people live at home and they are treated as the head of the household with great respect until the day they die. I've got an incredibly wealthy, powerful, successful Saudi businessman friend who is not traveling at the moment because his father, who is frankly out of it mentally, is ill, and he wouldn't dream of leaving him. So to switch to the royal family in your implied question, that is how they operate. And Crown Prince Sultan, who's just died, probably in his mid-80s, is now being succeeded almost certainly as Crown Prince by his brother Nayef, the interior minister, aged about 78, 79, not in the best of health. The king has just had a second back operation in the course of a year and is not in great health. But the whole system revolves around reverence for age. And just one other comparison with what you're talking about, Russia. Saudi Arabia is incredibly wealthy. Why are we in the West poor at the moment? To oversimplify, it's because we pay too much for our energy. For heating our homes, for running our cars or everything, where is that money? It's in Saudi Arabia. When the Arab Spring happened earlier this year, the king doubled the budget. He paid out, I think, $150 billion. All civil servants got an extra month's salary, just like that. They've got the money, and so long as that's the case, there's a lot going for the House of Saud.
Again, I'm speaking with British historian and author Robert Lacey, the author of Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. But these young women that you mentioned, princesses, studying at Georgetown, surely it's schizophrenic if you get a Western education and live the way that we live. And that seems to be universal in the Arab world, particularly this Arab Spring. It's the young people want to live fairly secular and modern lives. And more importantly, the refrain that you hear from the Arab Spring is we want dignity. We're sick of either kings or dictators and their cronies stealing us blind, and we want our share of the future. So should it be different? In other words, it seems to me that we're talking about an absolute monarchy, which is in itself almost extinct on the face of the earth, no parliament, nothing except the largesse of the leader, compared to this tectonic shift that's taking place amongst this young generation. And after all, in most Arab countries, the young are up to 50-60% of the population.
Yes, those are all good points, Ian. But as I've already said, one of the big differences between Saudi Arabia and the countries you've mentioned is just the sheer wealth. It's very interesting. The Arab Spring has affected republics. It has not affected the monarchies. We're not just talking Saudi Arabia here. We're talking about all the Gulf monarchies. We're talking about Jordan. We're talking about Morocco. These countries, well, Morocco and Jordan are not so wealthy, but to switch into a social mode, the Arab monarchies are very tribal systems. They are linked into the tribes. Their armed forces come from the tribes. And that means that in every tribe, in every village, in every community, you've got a head of the tribe who looks for allegiance higher up the chain and higher up the chain to the king. So you've got social networks in these tribal monarchies that you don't have in the republics where there's been such trouble and where, incidentally, they don't seem to have got much further for the revolutions that they've brought forward. Secondly, there is the point of the wealth in Saudi Arabia. A third and most important point, which is unique to Saudi Arabia, is that the king calls himself custodian of the two holy places. The royal family, and indeed the whole of Saudi Arabia, are immensely proud of the fact that 5 million or more pilgrims come to Saudi Arabia every year, that all around the world, the millions of Muslims in the world pray to Mecca and Medina. And therefore, that is not just actually a source of prestige and wealth to some degree when the pilgrims come. It's a matter of spiritual blessing that they look after the holy sites of Islam. It gives them credit in heaven. So it's tremendously important for them to maintain the traditional ways of life. And if you want to be cynical about it, it's very dangerous for them to get too radical or too liberal or too, you know, different. There are many, many traditional imams around the world who don't agree with democracy, who don't agree with equal rights for women. Now, that's the constituency that Saudi Arabia has to take account of as well.
Well, in terms of the Saudi peace initiative, which the Israelis gave the back of the hand to, as did the Americans, who supposedly are the honest brokers, recently the former retiring head of Mossad castigated the Israeli right for not taking up that opportunity because things are shifting. You've mentioned the showdown now between the Saudis and the other Sunni kings and the Iranians this plot, of course, the target of this plot, and it is a little hard to believe, but the target of the plot is a favorite of the king's, the Saudi ambassador to Washington. He's the fellow that apparently said that we have to cut off the head of the snake, meaning the Iranians. According to the Saudis, the Iranians were trying to destabilize Bahrain. That's why they invaded. So I think you could make the case, surely, Robert Lacey, that there's something of a surrogate war going on there already.
I think you're right. I myself, although, you know, quite pro-Saudi in some ways, didn't really buy what happened in Bahrain. I mean, it was crude realpolitik to go in there. I mean, the basic problem in Bahrain for the Saudis and for America, which has an enormous naval base there, is that really, the Sunnis are in a minority and the Shia in a majority. And were the proper rules of democracy to apply in Bahrain, you'd have the Shia winning the election. And from the little I know about Bahrain, it's really that enormous sense of injustice that's driving the trouble there. The Iranians don't need to interfere because there is this sense of blatant injustice, which has been perpetuated now by the Saudi invasion, and of course America turns a blind eye to it.
Well, actually, the U.S. and Robert Gates and others were critical of the Saudis and wished they would have encouraged the king to modernize and to liberalize and accept these, give some rights to the Shiite majority. I think the U.S., they may have turned a blind eye, but they at least went on the record saying that they thought that this heavy-handed military response was the wrong way to go.
Yes, well, we may have to differ on that one, Ian. I mean, went on the record but kept the American warships in a nice harbor.
At the end of the day, that's probably what it's all about. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. But just in closing, though, Robert Lacy, it seems to me that things are on a kind of collision course. You get the distinct feeling that Syria being an example, where the Iranians on the one hand are propping up the murderous Assad clan, giving them some serious money and logistical help through the IRGC, and on the other hand, the Saudis are calling for the overthrow of the Assads. I'm sure there's some serious behind the scenes activities going on in both cases. Where is it going to lead to, do you think?
You put your finger in on a very interesting area that people don't know enough about. But I think in terms of the big Middle Eastern power play, Syria is the sort of pawn, the arena that the two sides really want. And, of course, it has enormous implications for Israel as well, even if Israel's a bit of a spectator. One of the things people don't realize is, for example, that King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia comes from the Shamba tribe, who are an enormous tribe going across the middle of Arabia and into Syria. And this is one of the reasons why he has come out very fiercely in condemning the regime there.
Which is an Alawite Shia regime, right?
It is. It is. Strangely, the king had, perfectly good relationship with the young president of Syria. I remember seeing them together about 2 years ago when he came down to Riyadh, and he was, obviously getting on very well personally with the king. But when it comes to A, the Shia, and B, Iran, a Sunni monarchy like Saudi Arabia is absolutely unmovable and unapologetic and will not give way at all, or, as we saw with Bahrain, won't hesitate to go in and crush the opposition no matter what we in the West complain about.
Well, Robert Lacy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with British historian and author Robert Lacy. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, including Majesty, Biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom of Study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His other books include biographies of the gangster Meyer Lansky, Princess Grace of Monaco, and the study of Sotheby's Auction House. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can also sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.